Okay. Joe just told me a funny story. He said that last year he jumped up on the stage and the guy that was cheering said, "Next time take the steps." Which, you know, I love that because you hear that a lot around here, but I didn't really know that. Can you guys hear me? Seriously? Oh my gosh.
You want this to go?
Nah.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm just, don't. I'm on a roll up here, people. You know? Don't. You want me to put it back? I've never done this before, you know, in front of all of you guys. So I know you'll bear with me. Listen, I'm just really glad to be here today. I'm really, really excited about that workshop. It was fabulous. If you didn't get a chance to sit in, they did steps 1 through 3. They're going to do a continuation of the rest of the steps at 526 North Bridge Street, starting at 3 o'clock, if you guys are interested. And if you haven't done the steps or you want a little review or something, it was a great experience for me to remind myself of some things and how to practice the things that I have been learning thus far. And it's brilliant. And speaking of brilliant, I doesn't build you like this amazing job. I want to, you know, say bravo and boo. I mean, they just make it look easy. And the kind of work and commitment that goes on in here is just tremendous. I'm just am in awe. Some of you know a little bit about my story. You know that I came in 1994, and I looked at the steps on the wall. I saw that step 9, and I didn't have any problem. It didn't look like everything else seemed fine with me, but that step 9 was just the thing that was like, nah, I can't let an order. I can't go through with it. And so I didn't. And as a consequence, I remained an untreated alcoholic, and I wound up drinking again. So I could get, you know, 4 years and take a year off for bad behavior, get another 4 years, take a year and a half off for worse behavior, get 2 years, and then I couldn't get sober at all. And my last drink lasted me 6 years. So when I finally dragged my poor, tired, battered, one-legged, back old body back up on in here, by the grace of God, by the grace and mercy of God, I was given the gift of true desperation, and I was given a sponsor who knew how to follow the precise, specific, clear-cut instructions of the Big Book and take me through those steps. And when I first came in this program, I could have walked up those steps, and now I need some help. So if you don't want to wind up like this, you might want to do the steps too, or else this could be in your future. My life has been transformed as a result of that. Bill asked me to share for a few minutes, he said a very few minutes, about what I'm most excited about in my recovery today. And what I am really excited about are my amends. The very step that chased me out of these rooms and booze chased me right back in is the step I currently practice 10 and 11 and I work with others. But the step where I am seeing the most dramatic hand of God is in these amends. You know, when I got here, I thought I was desperate. I didn't, you know, I was a drink away from losing a career of a lifetime. And, you know, as a result, I wound up not doing those amends and not wanting to do, not being willing to do that. I did lose that career of a lifetime and the house and the neighborhood and the car and my health. I lost everything. And so when I finally got back here, I approached this thing with the desperation, with all the desperation of a drowning woman. It's been transformative. It's a pure transformation. The fact that I'm even willing, even the fact that I can even think that I owe someone an amends is huge. You know, because I was such a victim, and, you know, you did this to me, and I blamed you for the way that my life was, or probably more accurate, what my life wasn't. And you couldn't shift me. I could not be shifted from that on my own power. You could not have shifted it from me on your own power. It took an act of God to get me, to move me to the place where I could see myself more clearly. And it was the steps that did that. And then There were things I just didn't want known about me. I know that I look white and, you know, I'm a woman, I have an education, and people just don't expect criminal behavior from someone like me. And, you know, psychotic, antisocial, violent, and they would be wrong, right? And so I didn't want that known. That's one other reason I didn't initially want to do them in. And the other thing is that I, and then the other thing is I was so resentful of what you had done to me. And doing the steps this way, I got to see that my troubles were of my own making. And I got to see that it wasn't you, that I was seriously bedeviled. I, you know, Dan touched on it in the workshop. I had trouble in my personal relationships, couldn't control my emotional natures, misery, to, you know, prey to misery and depression, full of fear, couldn't make a living satisfying enough to keep me happy and sober, unable to be of any real help to anyone, full of fear, which is something I experienced just prior to getting on up here. And there's a tool for those things, and I was seriously bedeviled, and I thought, you did this to me. I thought my troubles were out there, not in here, and God is restoring me from the inside out. I got here, I was so, resentful isn't the word. I was so hateful, and if you cut me, I wouldn't have bled. It would have been green venom. And I couldn't go to sleep at night unless I thought of creative, inventive ways that I could harm you and inflict the most maximum amount of suffering and pain for the rest of your miserable life. You know, because that's just the kind of girl I am. And so as I began making these amends, I went to an institution, and I've done a lot of criminal stuff, and I went and made about for a serious criminal offense. And at the end of that amends, you know, and I'm going in a helpful and forgiving spirit, because that institution I didn't think had done well enough for me, and so I'm just going to, you know, help myself in a very big way. And when I went in a helpful and forgiving spirit, not hating that person anymore, but wanting to set him, his institution, these people free of what I had done to them, you know, and I did. I came to a place where I want to clean up my mistakes. I want to go to them, not my part, that's not what the book says, by the way, but my mistakes, and go to them and clean this up and go to them and try to set them free of what I did to them. And then once I started doing that, I'm noticing, I don't know what kind of God you got, but my God never gives to one child without giving to another. And as I set those people free, I began to get free. And I went to a woman that I mean, I don't care if you just listen to me in an AA meeting, I wanted to burn down your house, sleep with your husband, steal your dog. And that is, you know, that is for a minor infraction. And these were people I blame for the ruination of my life. So, as it turns out, I'm helping them, those people get free. I have been getting free, and that's what I'm most excited about in my life. I want all the freedom that God has for me. I want power in my life today. I've lived powerless for so long. I don't want to live in separation. I experienced some fear and had some separation from God, and just, you know, Dan was talking about how, and Sheldon were talking about in step two, either God is everything or he is nothing. And the ABCs, and God could and would if he were sought. And I have this problem with fear, and can God take me with that fear and move me beyond where I am into some place beyond where I've ever been before? And I'm seeing that. I see that almost every day in my life as I'm willing to turn to God. And if I can't see it, I turn to someone who knows how to do it, and they help me see. And I can't be more grateful for that. I want to be part of the I've Made All My Amends Club. I want to be clean in the world. I thought I got away with things all my life. And the truth is I didn't get away with anything, because the book says the great reality is deep within. And if the great reality is deep within every man, woman, and child, then he's in within you. And if I'm resentful from you, I'm separated from you, I'm separated from God. If I hurt you, I hurt myself. And as I clean this stuff up, my life is improving. As I make financial amends, my finances are improving. As I make my amends and my personal relationships, my personal relationships are improving. And I want more of this stuff. I want more of this. I busted over to the coast yesterday, bam and bam, because I had two amends I've been trying to make for 8 months. And I went over there, I knocked them out. That leaves me two left in California. Two gravesite amends. I've got to find both graves. And then I've got three in Oklahoma, one in South Dakota, one in Arizona, seven in Tennessee. Woo! Talk about a tornado. And I'm really excited about how God is going to sort that out for me, because I provide the willingness, and then He provides the courage, and He provides the ways and the means. And I will do everything on my end to make that happen, but He is going to sort out everything as He can. And I want to, I want this. I drank alcohol because I like the effect that it produced. And I'm making these amends because I like the effect that it produces. And I'm doing these steps because I like the effect that they produce, even far more than I ever got out of the drinking. So thanks for listening to me.
Now it's my privilege to introduce to today's speaker. He's our main speaker. Please help me warm him a Tulare County big welcome, Ron S. from Orange County.
Ron St. John, alcoholic. Hi, Ron. There you go. This is as far as okay. Is the mic okay? Am I not? Okay. I want to thank Bill for asking me to speak. It's an honor and a privilege, and a very high-quality head rush for me able to speak at an AA meeting. I just love hearing myself talk. No matter how many times I listen to myself tell my own story, I always find it utterly fascinating. I laugh, I cry, and I've heard it before. So, there we are. I want to thank Connie, was it? Yep, that was for an amazing 10-minute talk. Good job. Nice to sort of reminds me when I was new and they were telling me, don't worry about getting in touch with your feelings. Your feelings will get in touch with you once you get sober. I want to thank Sheldon and Dan for their workshop this morning. It was really a very moving experience. I'm privileged like got to be part of that. I didn't see that coming, but it was a nice treat. And so anyways, I will share in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Now, there's just one small point to make before I drift into this story that I always like to say about when I say that out of chapter 5, we share in a general way. I think that some people take that a little bit too far. I don't think share in a general way means that you gloss over all the embarrassing details of your life and that you just preach and brag about your grandchildren. And there's a hazard for me to do that because I'm always really interested in my own preaching and I have really cute grandchildren, so I could drift into that easily. But if you look at page 29 of the big book, 29, it makes it pretty clear that we fully disclose, we use the words fully disclose, and it's what actually happened. And it apologizes just in case you're talked in bad taste or your story's in bad taste, but that's the only way to reach new people who are desperate for our program, is to fully disclose and it actually happened. But this is going to be a pretty raw talk, and you'd better we'll get rid of the kids, and this is not the Girl Scout meeting. This is AA, okay? So I was born quite a long time ago in the mid-1950s in a place you've heard of, but probably not been to, Tombstone, Arizona. Thank you. So just in case you never thought you'd meet anybody from Tombstone, now you have. I didn't stay there long enough to work in any ranches or join any posses. I really only lived there for 9 days. But I'm still from there, and I'm not letting go of that. We moved back to, both my parents were from Michigan, and so I just grew up in Plain Old Michigan. And I was the oldest of five kids. My dad worked his way through college and then got a job selling computers for IBM. And my mom was a ballet teacher. So, I had what should have been a normal Midwestern type childhood, except for the fact that I was there. I just felt always different and weird, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. I don't know what 3-year-olds can do to feel so guilty, but I somehow did. And like I say, my mom was a ballet teacher, so I got what every man here wishes he had, ballet lessons. Also tap dancing and violin. They thought I'd be good at the violin. I don't know. And so there wasn't a lot of pressure to be all masculine in my house for some reason. And any chance I had of being a badass from Tombstone was just gone. I was that little skinny kid who carried his violin to school on Tuesdays. That was me. Okay? I didn't really stick with any of those things, although once I was 10, I started to do theater. I started acting on stage, which came really easy to me. It was really fun for me, and I got lots of compliments. It just seems kind of simple. They tell you what to say. You just go up and say it, and then they act like you're a genius. So I just did those. I did that obsessively, one play after another. You know how we are. Anything worth doing is worth doing to excess. And I would read plays in the library. I would listen to show tunes on the record player. We had record players back then, if you knew. And try out an audition, because, you know. Otherwise, I was just this weird little kid, and nobody liked me. I mean, I had 4 brothers and sisters, but they didn't seem to care that much for me either. I would just sit around playing by myself. I would go in the basement. We had basements there, and I would play, I would play Monopoly by myself. I would see all 4 sides. Just, there's always some other tweaker who did that. I was a tweaker, no drugs, and they hadn't even invented the word tweaker yet, and I already was one. And I kind of wanted to be an alcoholic when I grew up, to tell you the truth. Alcohol seemed so glamorous to me in the old movies I would watch and things like that. And then my parents, they had these friends from a little theater group they were in that would come over to our house for these cocktail parties. And you could hear the ice, and you could hear people. Everything was all of a sudden so funny to them, and they would laugh, ho, 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 ho. And then you're going, ho, ho, like this, ho, ho, ho. And I thought, wow, I don't even know what they're saying, but I want to drink like that too. And fancy little cocktails, and you'd see it in the movies. Or I had this W.C. Fields record that I just memorized, and he was just my hero. W.C. Fields was a comedian in the 1930s who made alcoholism seem really funny. And he had a lot of expressions that I would just meditate on, even after I was drinking. Like, every man needs something to believe in. I believe I'll have a drink. I loved that. So I'm learning W.C. Fields. And the same thing like with drugs. There was no real stigma to drugs. I wanted to be a drug addict. I thought I would be cool as a drug addict. I would wear this old army jacket that my dad had, and some sunglasses and a hat maybe, and take certs and just try to look like I was on drugs. You know, listen to my Woodstock album and just pretend to be on acid or something. We learned about drugs. We had this, what they called a film strip. If you're new, I have no way of explaining what a film strip is, but they had one, and it's what taught us about drugs. And they warned us that a pusher was going to come to our school, and he would give us free drugs to get us hooked so we would become addicts, and then we would be addicted. We waited for that guy. Where all there was at my school was a big drug shortage. It was like, you got to know. People kept offering to buy drugs from me because I just looked like I probably had some. I finally When I was 16, I finally discovered alcohol and also pot, and my life got much better because it completely changed my life, because now the world was different. Once I drank, I liked pot. I was kind of a lost in space guy anyway, and so pot sort of worked for me in that way. Plus, it was politically more acceptable for us young hippies to smoke pot, because that wasn't like our parents' generation with the cocktails and the ring-a-ding-ding kind of thing. And we hated our parents' generation so much that they wanted to send us to Vietnam, and we thought it was just so bogus. And but then, at the same time as alcohol seemed like selling out somehow, I'm an alcoholic. So you get me near some Annie Green Springs or Boone's Farm, and it just so completely changes the way I feel. Now all of a sudden I like you and you like me. The world is a completely different place. I really felt from the time I was 16 until I stopped drinking when I was 34, that if you hadn't seen me drunk, you just didn't know me. Because that wasn't me. The real me is when I drink. And that was the only way I knew how to be myself, was to drink. So I guess I didn't get in all that much trouble from drinking and such at first. It's just, it did change my life. It changed the way I felt about things, and life got better. When I was 17, we moved back to Arizona for no good reason. My dad remembered liking it and wanted a Geographic, so we moved to Arizona. I spent about a year feeling sorry for myself out there in the heat, and it was, I met all these Mormons, which was, fine. No reason to talk bad about them. They never did anything mean to me, but sort of felt a little out of place. And I did get into just a little bit of trouble, and I'll just mention this briefly, is that I was... happened to be ditching school in an alley behind a Circle K smoking a little tiny roach like this big. And some little kid comes running back in the alley with the police following him, and he jumps into a dumpster to hide in the dumpster. Which kind of surprised me, and it was, the whole situation was starting to seem kind of unreal. And the police followed him there, and I was not a real experienced criminal. I didn't understand the real code of conduct or whatever, so I just pointed to the dumpster and I said, "He's in there." But that didn't seem to distract them. They kind of noticed me, and they arrested me and searched me and told me my rights and put me in the back of their police car, and I sat in the back of the police car and cried. They drove me around town, and then they gave me to the principal's office at my high school. It was sort of a catch-and-release kind of a thing back then. And I just mention that because that is my whole criminal record. That is my jacket. That if I had a nickel for every time I was arrested, I would have a nickel. That's it. Here in AA, that makes me a real lightweight, and I understand that. When I went to law school years later, and I was taking a class in criminal procedure, I was like the only one there who had been arrested. I was able to chime in. We were studying Miranda and all. Wait. Let me give you a little different perspective on this. Okay, so I waited out my time in the desert, and I got a scholarship to go to college, lucky me, and so I decided to come out here to Hollywood to become a movie star. And I started out as a drama student at the University of Southern California. Yay, Trojans. USC usually is very well represented at any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a fun place to go to school in the 1970s. Drink, 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 party, 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 fun all the time. Even there were university-sponsored parties, and I know I wouldn't be mistaken about this, where they served free liquor. They had the university sponsored a drinking contest in our dorm. We were like 18 years old. It wasn't even legal for us to drink. Why they? I don't think they still do that, but I know they did that in the 70s. I was there drinking. I appreciated free liquor because I was very broke. It's that whole myth of about USC students being rich, it's not like you show up on campus and then you all of a sudden end up with a bunch of money in your pocket. If you're poor to begin with, then you're still poor. And the amount that I wanted to drink in relation to the amount of money that I had was a problem, which is the alcohol cost. So free liquor was very important to me, and I got as much of it as I possibly could. That's why I never fully understood all the AA speakers talk about drinking in bars. I keep thinking those must be the rich alcoholics. I remember going to a bar and they wanted to charge me like $3 to get this much gin. And I'm like, seriously? Have you been to the grocery store? What's the appeal? I would do my drink even when I went to bars. I would drink before I went to the bar because it just seems like simple math, you know. So I say that if I was going to go out, and I'm not going to go out, but just in case, if I was, I wouldn't go to no damn bar. I would go to Costco. Think about that. So anyways, I'm hitting up every free party that I possibly can and having lots of fun, and I joined a fraternity. That's where the liquor was. No surprise. And I don't think I've ever fit in anywhere as well as I fit in that fraternity. We would go around town drinking and singing obscene songs, and we would get live bands and make big old bowls of mostly alcohol fruit punch and service 18-year-old girls in gigantic paper cups, and it was a party. It was on, and it's hard for me to picture myself getting sober at that time in my life. And if you are young and you're here, you belong here and you should stay here. I really feel like if you are old enough to die from this disease, you are already old enough to get sober. And there's no such thing as being too young. We have teenagers at my group down in Newport Beach that literally come to the meeting on their skateboard. You know, it's that young. They're young, young. But we don't treat them like kids. They are fellow alcoholics like us, and they're here to get sober. It's just hard for me to picture leaving those drinking parties at the fraternity house so that I could take a bus out to Downey and I could eat half of a donut while I watch a middle-aged man tell the story of his life, right? Somewhat similar to what you guys are doing right now. I was having a great time. I dropped out of the drama department. Drama people were sort of getting on my nerves, and I wanted to seem a little bit more normal. Plus, I was way tired of people thinking I was gay. Okay? It's okay to be gay. I know there's no gay people up here in the Central Valley, but it's... Even at the time back then, nobody ever seemed to mean it as a compliment when they said that. I was just this long-haired, skinny drama student who knew a lot of show tunes, okay? That didn't mean that I wanted to have sex with other men. It just doesn't work that way. I had a different sexual problem, and I will share it with you guys since we're all so close. You just have to promise to keep it a secret, and that applies to anybody listening to me on MP3 anytime between now and the 22nd century, but okay. Here was my sexual problem. I wanted sex way more often than I was ever going to get it, okay? And I don't mean I wanted it just a little bit, thought it might be a nice idea. I mean I was in pain. My hair hurt. My skin hurt. I needed to touch some girl parts or somebody was going to have to get hurt, really. And I was very shy. I was afraid of girls. I was afraid of rejection. And then that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because what women value in a man as a mate is self-confidence. That's what they are instinctively drawn to. They just can't help themselves. Like that whole... The whole cliche about the bad guys being drawn to bad guys, they're not attracted to just any bad guy. They want the bad guy who's in charge of all the other bad guys. Right? So if you just sort of cower in the corner and you're like, oh, you probably don't want to dance with me, you're too scared or something, okay, never mind. That becomes the self-fulfilling prophecy and you get nowhere. Now, alcohol was a complete solution to this problem. Because with Once I drank, I felt more self-confident. I sort of didn't care if I was rejected or not, and I was willing to go out and try. So my probability of success increased dramatically. It went up from about 0% to about 5%. Okay? That's an important difference. If you're in sales, that's like once a month instead of never. Okay? Yeah. And then, not to overthink this, but that's the supply side of the equation. Now let's look at the demand side. Because once you drink enough, who cares? Now you don't need it anymore anyways. And drinking is just so much easier. No offense to you ladies out here, but you're kind of a lot of trouble. The relationship that you have with a bottle of Southern Comfort is very simple. You buy it, you pour it, you drink it. You don't have to wait for the bottle to be in the mood before you drink it. Okay? You don't have to be nice to its friends. You don't have to remember its birthday. It doesn't care if you were drinking something else the night before. To find a girl like that is difficult, by the way. But alcohol is just so damn easy. And I would repeat that action over and over and over. And I'll just mention one more thing about this before I finally talk about something else eventually. Which is, I've been here for about 24 and a half years, and I've developed this long resentment against so many beautiful women that will come up to these podiums and they'll say, oh, well, I would just drink and then I would black out and I didn't know who I was going to wake up with. Okay. Where were you? Because I would drink and I would black out and I would wake up on the floor in my bathroom by myself. Which is a very sensible place, by the way. If you're lying down, you can't fall down and hurt yourself. The tile is very smooth and comforting and cool. You know how to remember how that was. It's conveniently located, made perfect sense. So anyways, what kind of ruined those happy days for me was to finally figure out that I am an alcoholic. I took those "Are you an alcoholic?" tests. Those questions do not seem fair. Have you ever had a complete loss of memory? What do you mean ever? It's not like it happened every single time. Or do you drink in the morning? Of course I drink in the morning if there's any left. I'm not going to let it go to waste. Seems like a silly question. Do you drink alone? Drinking alone is a sign of intelligence. You don't have to bother with all the silly mixing and counting and blah, blah, blah. You know, you remember, I just remember all that thing. This goes back probably about 30 or so years, where it was in style that you would do the tequila and you would have like some salt and you would have like a lime and you had to after a few of those, you realize, you know, tequila tastes fine. What is up with that salt and the lime? Skip it. Okay, so drink alone, you get right down to business. You don't have to share it. But anyways, I figured out that I took that test, and then you're definitely an alcoholic. And then I worried, from all those old movies I'd seen, that other people would find out that I'm an alcoholic. They'd make me go to that AA thing where you don't take the first drink, because the first drink, blah, blah, blah. And I knew that was not a practical solution for me. Because I have a special kind of alcoholism, the kind where I still have to drink. And I know that if I try to explain that to anyone, even though it's the God's truth, it will not sound right. It'll just make me sound more like an alcoholic. So now that's a secret. Maybe an alcoholic is a secret. And it's secret, secret, secret. I just started piling up secrets, and I became more and more isolated, essentially. I think alcohol does that to pretty much everybody. The first stage of our drinking, we become more social because we're more uninhibited. And then eventually it takes us to a place where we're more and more isolated because we don't want to deal with other people and their judgment and their whatever, and it's just easier just to drink alone. So I made my drinking secretive and controlled, and I did that for about another dozen years after that point. I finished college. I got married. I went to law school. I became an attorney. I had 4 kids, and I lived in a nice house in the San Gabriel Valley, which doesn't sound like like a low-bottom kind of a drunk story, but it didn't feel like a success story to me. I felt like a fraud and a failure, and I just felt miserable and sick and sorry for myself all the time. My job was dreadful. It was both too boring and also too stressful and stuff I couldn't handle or didn't want to handle and didn't want to do that now, and I had to do that. The home kind of stuff, I'm just not good at fixing things. I can't help it. I took ballet lessons. Nobody taught me how to fix plumbing. And there were so many things in my life that I really should have been grateful for. And you just don't have appreciation for things as they're happening, like the fact that my kids were still all around and that they adored me and everything, that my credit card still worked. And then I was also with my first wife. She started out so sweet and cheerful when she was like 19, and then she had four kids and just got all grouchy and mean. And I mean, I don't mean to complain about her, but what the hell, she's not here. And she wanted to reach out and say, I love you. Do you love me back? Are you participating in this relationship? But she never said that, and I never heard that. And everything that she did say just sounded like nag, 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 nag. Why do you always blah, blah, blah? How come you never blah, blah, blah? When are you going to fix the blah, blah, blah? I called her Big Chief, We Need a New, because it was, we need a new couch, we need a new chair, we need a new car, we need a new kitchen, we need a new house. And all I'm thinking is, why can't I just die? Seriously. Other people die. I would like to die. I would like to die of a disease that doesn't hurt too much and isn't my fault. Maybe I would like to go to jail. Jail would actually work for me. It's relaxed. Jail this weekend would be perfect. I could go to jail for something I didn't do, and later people would feel sorry for me, and then just... And she would say something like, what are you thinking about? I should have said, I'm thinking about suicide or jail because you drive me crazy. That's what I should have said. That would have given our relationship a chance. But I never did. Here's what I said. This was the tone of voice. This was the volume, everything. I said, oh, nothing. I'm just tired. So that's how much fun it was to be married to me. I was part at that time, like the whole 80s happened, and I didn't even know what happened in the 80s, really. I have to watch movies to figure out what happened in the 80s. I just wasn't paying attention. I'm living in this little world. I married into this gigantic Italian family, and that becomes something that sort of consumes your entire life, because it's like every weekend is either somebody's birthday or graduation or baptism or whatever, and each party is the same. There's a big sheet cake, and then it's just something different written on the sheet cake, and the same Italian rolls and the cold cuts and the lasagna and the pasta and the cannoli. And it's like, they would use words that I don't even think they were Italian words. I think they just made them up. They would, their word for me is they called me a babu. Babu is, means like a stupid person, like an idiot. So I was the babu. And, they would ask me, some words I picked up, like panza and kulu. You can kind of figure those out. It's like you're sitting on your kulu and the panza. Those make sense. And pupu bedus for pretty babies. And I supplied lots of pupu bedus for the whole group. And, I was part of that whole population explosion of Italians in the San Diego Valley, and it was a different expression they would use. Why you got a funja? And I tried to look up that word. I couldn't get funja. Is it like mushroom? Like I have a mushroom on my face? Was it? I finally figured it out years later. I watched an Italian movie. Same context, same tone of voice. The people in the movie said, che faccia? And the subtitle was, why the long face? So funja was just this Sicilian mispronunciation of faccia, meaning face. So it was like, what's up with your face? Because I was feeling so sorry. So what was up with my face is that there was no liquor at those parties. I'm thinking, where's all the vino? Don't you guys watch TV? You're supposed to like wine. Where's the wine? I never heard of such a thing. So I used all the skills I developed at the University of Southern California, and I set up the bar. And I invented this whole bar to be part of the whole party scene. And I was good at it, too. I'm a good bartender. That's just a waste of talent. I came up with a drink that even they would like. It's just being lightweights and non-drinkers. And this is a tip for the non-drinkers. I would fill a glass with ice, then I would fill it about half full of Kahlua, and then with milk. They thought I was a genius. That was delicious. And then for my drink, I would make it look pretty much the same, except I filled the glass with vodka. And then I added just enough milk and Kahlua so that it looked like about the same color, and then I could have, like, a drink that was really a drink, that wasn't just going to waste my time. And then I would top it off with more vodka as I was drinking, because that way, in case anybody asked, I only had one drink. It's just I kept topping it off. But that's still the same drink, right? That makes sense. I was thinking about that recently, because it was about 20 years after I invented that whole rationalization for how you're really only drinking one drink, when I was being diagnosed with throat cancer at UC Irvine. And I was talking to every single research doctor there who was asking me the same questions about how much I drank, because apparently that's a risk factor for throat cancer. And I said, gee, you're not going to believe this, but I am a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 13 years of sobriety, and I don't drink at all. This surprised them not at all. They're like, yeah, but when you drank, how much did you drink? How many drinks per week? And I'm like, who keeps track of something like that? It was a long time ago. I don't know why that is. But that was what was relevant to them. Which brings us to the other point, that no matter how successful you are at keeping your drinking a secret, you can't hide your drinking from your own body. It keeps score of how much you're drinking. So there I was in my late 20s. I had hives. I had gout. Forget gout. I was in my 20s. I had gout. I had ulcers, all this stuff, because I drank too much. All those problems went away, and I became much healthier after I finally did give up drinking. Especially, I gave up drinking pretty fast. While I was having all those ulcer problems and everything, I ended up going into therapy, and I did like we did in the 80s with the exercise and the grapevines and the aerobics and the Nautilus and the self-help books and all this kind of thing. But then I finally did discover the 12-step world, only because my poor first wife wound up with this case of bulimia, which just shocked the hell out of me. But she was keeping a secret, which wasn't too hard to do with me, because I wasn't paying that much attention to her. And I had to put her into a rehab for her bulimia, into the eating disorders group, which was part of the chemical dependency group at this local mental hospital, essentially. And her rehab was the most intense 3 weeks of my life. I don't think it meant as much to her, but I felt like I'm finally going to solve all my problems, because all my problems is just her, and now we're going to fix her. And what could be more wonderful than rehab, really, when you think about it? You sit around your PJs all day talking about yourself. Somebody else does all the cooking. I don't get people to complain about rehab. And plus, there's that whole notion, that you've hit bottom. Everybody's hit bottom. Everybody was just about to die a week from Tuesday, except they hit their bottom and they came here and now they have a new life. To say that you've hit bottom is the most optimistic statement you could ever make. You have no way of knowing if you've really hit bottom. Stuff could still keep getting worse for you. What makes you think that everything from now on is going to be better? But it's such a wonderful optimism, like we found the cure for everything. They tell me the first day I'm there, I need to come back for the codependence group. So stupid me, I'm like, codependence? Gosh, what's that? And they say, oh, well, listen, codependency. Codependency is this new disease. You've probably never heard of it because we just made it up a couple months ago. Not only do you have it, but you are in denial about the fact that you have it. I'm like, wow. So I didn't stay in denial for long. I jumped on the codependency bandwagon. I read any book that had codependency in the title. I started going to meetings of Adult Children Anonymous, and I just actually read the big book, because it was one of the books they gave her at the rehab, and I wanted her to get better faster, and so I read it for her. So that, you know, that makes sense. I was, at the time I read the great book, I happened to be drinking. I was drinking some straight Kahlua out of one of my kids' sippy cups. Just because, I don't know, it's a long story, but it's, and saying, I can relate to that. Oh, that sounds like me. Let me check off this certain type of hard drinker and go, I thought I was going to find my name, address, and social security number in that book. And then it holds out this hope of promise that you're going to get better. So I was going to ACA for a while, and I tried to stop drinking on my own. The last drink that I did have was July 13th, 1990. And it was after that that I found out about keeping track of the numbers of drinks that you, or number of days you've had since you drank. And then you gain prestige within the group based on that amount of time. And I'm so OCD that once you get me counting like that, there's no stopping me. And so I wanted to maybe get those chips and such that they talked about. But at the same time, I became completely miserable because now no matter how badly I needed a drink, I just couldn't get to one because I didn't want to start over again counting on my days. Which meant I was just turning into a monster. I grew this big, scary beard because I wanted people to understand how much I was changing on the inside, and I wanted to look more like a monster on the outside. So I would just grow this beard, and I would never trim it. And it was until eventually I had a sponsor who told me to, so whatever. But it was, it got so bad that I eventually did go to AA, and I hated to. I hated to have to do that. I was, at that time at ACA meetings, I was already the secretary, treasurer, secretary, cleanup, setup person, but AA meetings, they just terrified me. Everybody looked so damn ugly. It just seemed like such a horrible place, and there were those books, and oh no. And I got to where I was having these horrible anxiety attacks. That's what I thought they were. Basically, I was detoxing. And I got to where I'd be like, I don't care what happens. I'm just going to be honest with this stupid meeting. I hate my life. I don't care if I never get back, have to go back to this meeting. There's other meetings. And I'm just like, I'm a real man. Okay, I'm Ron. I'm an ungrateful alcoholic. I'm sober for 93 days. And don't clap. Enough with the clapping. The clapping's driving me crazy. Not at all happy to be here. The steps are stupid. I haven't met anyone at all that I hear that I like. I don't even remember why I'm trying to stay sober. Thank you for letting me share. So what do you think happens? They all come up and hug to me. And they said, you're so funny. I love it when newcomers are honest. You have to get a commitment here and keep coming back. So what are you going to do to get yourself kicked out of this place, really? Sorry. Well, I got a commitment. I kept coming back. You know, and life got quite a bit better. Well, I mean, it kind of got worse, and then it got better in a way. I kind of went and got that divorce that I'd been saving up for, and I took over as a secretary of a step study meeting, and this super beautiful, out-of-my-league kind of girl was coming to the meetings, who had about the same amount of time and was kind of going through the same things I was going through. I was getting divorced. I was totally broke and paying all my money in child support with four kids, and she was paying all her money in child support for kids she only saw on the weekend. She had three kids. And so we had to get together and have coffee, obviously, and so we stayed friends for a few years, and then I chased her around and finally caught her, and now we have been married for almost 20 years. She was your speaker just last year, and I was here doing her 10 minutes, and so that was, you know, the good things like that happened in my sobriety. Things gradually did kind of come together at work and whatever, in all different parts of my life. I'll mention just briefly the worst thing that I had to deal with in sobriety was when one of my stepsons died in 2001, April 2001. His name was Jordan. We'd have favorites, but you couldn't help having a favorite if it was Jordan. He was a big, friendly kid sitting and played cards with me. He was a gigantic kid. He weighed like 240 pounds. He's the only one of my seven kids who ever really appreciated my cooking. He just ate whatever I cooked and asked for more. He's the only one of my kids who gave me some of his clothes because he had outgrown them and figured that they would fit me. But anyways, we lost him on April the 19th, 2001. And it was... You know, how do you do something like that? You don't, but you, we kept going to meetings, and we kept checking in with our sponsors, and We got a lot of support from our AA friends. We really did. It was our best source of support. AA is so well designed for any kind of a crisis. All this kind of one day at a time, keep it simple. That works in a crisis. You don't necessarily need to keep those models in mind if you're on vacation in Tahiti. But with the stuff that we go through, it does seem to make a lot of sense. Suit up, show up, do the next indicated thing. Stay in the solution. That advice has worked for me on so many different things. The financial problems that I've dealt with, the loss of the child, the divorce, the custody issues that we had with all of our kids. What do you do? You suit up, you show up, you do the next indicated thing. And that's worked with us on a lot of things. I went through the throat cancer that I had mentioned before. It happened just 3 years after we lost Jordan. All of a sudden I had malignant tumors in my throat. That's a bad day. And then you hear about that. But I went through that. And I got to learn about, now I've cheated death twice, because now I've gone 11 years cancer-free after the radiation treatment. Yay! Well, there's a good chance I'll die of something else eventually. Even the insurance company thinks that. I'm glad to hear that. I have a really strong chance of living past 70 years old, according to Transamerica Insurance. and they spend a lot of time looking into that question. Anyways, I really want to remember what I did. Was about 13 years ago, after we lost Jordan and before I got the cancer, that I got a new sponsor. My wife made a very strong suggestion, and her sponsor suggested that I get a Pacific Group sponsor. So I'm a member of Pacific Group, but I had a different sponsor. So I got a Pacific Group sponsor, and I got this badass psychotic murderer by the name of Frank Jones. And some of you might know him. He spoke a lot. And Frank, he was a tough guy. He survived two different wars and a gunshot wound to the head. He didn't get shot in the head in either of the wars. He was in the Vietnam War and Desert Storm. He got shot in the head because he had a mistress who found out that he got his wife pregnant, and she shot him in the head. But it was, he managed to survive pretty much anything except that Agent Orange caught up with him and he succumbed to cancer 27 days ago. So I sort of feel at liberty to make a kind of a tribute to him. He had this deep, gravelly voice, and in the last part of his life, he was basically an actor who pretended to be a tough guy. He was in, like, commercials and background in movies and things like that. It was like checking in with Clint Eastwood every day. You know, I'd call him, like, hello, Ron St. John, checking in. He's like, hello, Ron St. John, how the hell are you? I'd be like, well, you know, it's my birthday. I always get depressed on my birthday. He says, how old are you? I said, 47. He said, 47? I said, no, I'm 40. Oh, never mind. I get your point. He says, do you want me to sing happy birthday to you? Because I will. I'm like, never mind. But it was hard to be depressed about stuff like that. After talking to him like that, he had that same kind of dry sense of humor. It was, I called him on the day that I got the cancer diagnosis, the day that they found the malignant tumors. I'm like, Frank, it's wrong. You know, I got those testicles back, and I do have malignant tumors in my throat. He says, do you have any life insurance? I said, yeah. He said, maybe you should add me to your policy. That's why, you know, when he was going through this illness, I called him every day. I called him every day for 13 years. He never told me to stop. He knows how to not answer the phone. He's too damn sick. And I told him, and I went for months just being surprised that he answered the phone, thinking he was going to die any minute. And I would tell him, you know, this about to die shit's making me kind of squirrely. But after everything he told me, I figured I could tell him anything. And so tell him that you're like that bad guy in the Terminator, that they, you know, about the gunshot wound to the head and the wars. They could chop you in half. The two halves would just crawl back together. So he says, hey, Peg, he tells his wife, Ron St. John's trying to kill me. He's making me laugh, and I can't breathe when I laugh. Yeah, too bad. But, you know, he stopped breathing on at 2:15 a.m. on 2:15 in the year 2015. It was a rare thrust, I just remember. So I just, you know, it's been a big deal for our group. We had a memorial for him a couple weeks ago that completely filled the university synagogue. There was probably about 700 people there, and his life touched a lot of lives. He spoke a lot of different places, and he helped a lot of people, like he's helped me. And, you know, I got to talk to him every day. So it's sort of depressing, the thought that, you know, the next stuff that happens, I won't be able to check in with him anymore. I got a new sponsor. I got one the same day that he died. I called a guy that I'd been kind of had my eye on, and so I had another sponsor and all. But anyway, it's, let me mention briefly the found thing. I sort of cut myself off talking about the cancer once I had the cancer diagnosis and survived it and all. Which is, I discovered the difference between surviving alcoholism versus surviving cancer. And alcoholism will kill you just as dead as cancer. Okay? But people's attitude is so different. When you have cancer, people you barely know start forming prayer groups for you. The insurance company is willing to pay anything for anything, and you just are covered for everything. And it's then there's with alcoholism, not so much. You know, it's like people find out you're alcoholic, they don't start forming a prayer group for you. Nobody's going to wear those little yellow bracelets for us alcoholics. They're not going to have any walk-a-thons to try to save the alcoholics. Nobody has that attitude. And as cancer patients, the treatments for cancer basically consist of radiation or chemotherapy, which means basically you're poisoning yourself in a way that we wouldn't even do to prisoners of war, or else they will chop off some body parts, right? Which is a scarier thought for us throat cancer patients than it is for breast cancer patients, because as much as people like their breasts, there's just a whole lot of things in your throat that you want to keep, you know, so you can swallow and move your head around, you know, not to be all maudlin about it. But anyway, and here's us as cancer patients. We just sign the consent form. Oh, missed 3 months of work? Okay. Oh, you're going to poison me? Okay. Okay. Or you're going to chop something off? Okay. It was the last consent form like that that I signed that cut off a piece of my tongue. It was hurt like that. Thickens, by the way. I remember myself, people get pierced on purpose. You know what I did the next day? I went to the yard. I went to Clancy's yard the next day, and I saw Frank. And Frank said, "Hey, Ron, come over here. Let me see your tongue." He said, "Hey, Clancy, come here and look at Ron's mouth. They cut off a piece of his tongue." And Clancy said, "Well, it must not have been a very big piece because they hadn't shut him up." When I think back on that, I know it happened, and I just feel like it's such a weird memory to have, really, because both Frank and Clancy are such iconic figures in AA, and that somehow 20 years from now I'll still have that damn story, you know, and I know it happened. But it's just one of those unexpected things, and it's just, it helps take the edge off a little bit, you know, when you insist on enjoying life. But in any event, the cancer will find anything, do anything, even when the cures are like POW torture. The cure for alcoholism, here's what will save your life. Read that book, the one I just pointed to when I knocked over the microphone. Read that book, come to meetings, get a sponsor, take commitments and do the steps. That's the cure for alcoholism. Here's us when we hear that. Oh no, my case isn't that bad. It would be like me going to the cancer center and saying, you know, I'm only stage 3. If I get to stage 4, maybe I'll have some treatment, you know. There's going to be somebody here worse. This is all you gotta really do is read a damn book and come to meetings. Your life gets saved, your life gets better. Alright, so if you stay sober for 24 years, there's no guarantee that you're gonna live in a beautiful house near the beach and that you're gonna have a great job and be married to a beautiful, sexy redhead and drive a new car. Even though that is what happened to me, ha ha. What we pretty much guarantee is that you'll sleep through the night and wake up in the morning with a clear head and a clear conscience, and whatever crap it is you have to deal with in between meetings, there's going to be somebody here that has been through the same thing and can point you in a good direction. It's a good way to live, and you can live that way too. You just keep coming back to these meetings, you do the stuff we do, and your life gets better. Thank you, Lisa.